Good afternoon, and welcome to your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm here with you every Tuesday at 2 p.m. talking to you about healthcare and exercise trends. Today's show is about the hidden dangers of residential pesticides. In the studio, I have with me Arthur Slater, entomologist and instructor and director of pest control services at the University of California, where they use less invasive, safer treatments, and Justin Rubin, who is the Bay Area community organizer for Pesticide Watch. As usual, I'll open up the phone lines for your participation roughly at 2:40, and I'd really appreciate it if people would wait until I say that I'm opening up the phone lines. When we do that, the number will be in or out of the area code 510-848-4425, and I'll repeat the number when we're ready to go. If you need to order a tape of today's show, if you miss parts of it, or if you have to call me during the week, please do it normal. That's not coming out well. Let's try that again. You can reach me during normal business hours, or you can listen to the voicemail for information on how to order a tape. That number is 707-769-1458, and that'll also be repeated toward the end of the show. Now, I want to welcome my guests and introduce them, and then I'll explain why I wanted to do this show. Arthur Slater received his graduate degree in entomology in 1974 from UC Berkeley. His specialty is urban and industrial entomology. Mr. Slater is the academic coordinator for courses in structural pest control taught through UC Berkeley Extension, and he's been the senior environmental health and safety technologist responsible for vector control services and pesticide safety at UC Berkeley since 1973. Welcome to you, Art Slater.
Thank you.
Justin Rubin is the Bay Area coordinator for Pesticide Watch. He provides information, materials, organizing and strategy assistance, and networking opportunities to community groups and individuals who want to reduce pesticide use and promote safer alternatives in their schools, parks, apartment buildings, workplaces, and neighborhoods. He's a graduate of Green Corps Environmental Grassroots Organizing Training Program. As Green Corps' Bay Area field organizer, he worked with community groups around the Bay Area to stop efforts to weaken toxic waste cleanup laws and to mobilize student voters. He also worked to end taxpayer subsidies to polluting industries. He's also the Bay Area coordinator for Rainforest Action Network's Old Growth Redwood Boycott campaign, and he spent the summer as the Vermont Public Interest Research Group's Bottle Bill campaign coordinator, directing a statewide citizen outreach canvas. Graduated with honors in 1996 from Dartmouth College with a BA in Environmental and Evolutionary Biology and Environmental Studies. Welcome to you, Justin Rubin.
Thanks. That's probably more than anyone needs to know, but
well, thanks for the intro. Now they know everything.
I guess.
Well, what they know is that you're really doing, you're fighting the good fight, at least according to what we all feel here in the studio. We may have people who disagree with us, I'm sure, but I wanted to do the show. Normally, as much as certainly the topics of the show are going to reflect interests of mine or curiosities of mine, in this case, something very personal happened to me, and it alerted me to something that I suspected but never understood to my core in the way that I do now, which is, what happens when somebody who lives very close to you decides to do something which, for you, for your understanding of the world, is an extremely dangerous, toxic thing and may affect your health in a way that you do not wish to be affected? How much control do you have? What I discovered from an experience I just had is that you do not have a lot of control, and, in fact, it's very difficult to get important information in this situation. Very frightening. What happened to me is that I learned sort of by accident that my neighbor, who actually was an older woman who passed, when her sons sold the house, there was an offer on the table. A termite company came in and did a termite report and discovered powder post beetles, presumably powder post beetles, and a very invasive infestation. This is stuff that I had to drag. It was very hard to find any of this out. But he casually mentioned that on July 15th they were going to tent this house. Now, I knew that there were alternative treatments, but I suspected this was not one. And I went ahead and contacted people I knew who do non-invasive treatments and asked for the number of different fumigating companies. And I called around because I didn't get a lot of cooperation from my neighbor. He didn't want his sale threatened. He didn't want me making trouble. I discovered that they were going to tent and fumigate with methyl bromide. Called Pesticide Watch. Pesticide Watch is not neutral, so I was rather alarmed by the person I talked to. They sent me several pages on methyl bromide, including information about people who had died from exposure to buildings near them. I actually didn't need to know. I mean, for me, it wasn't the death situation. It was more that I just know that these materials are extremely dangerous. What I didn't know is how much methyl bromide has been, how dangerous it is, and how much they've been trying to get rid of it, and to no avail because our governor keeps vetoing the bills. In any case, what I went through in terms of the lack of notification, the fact that this was going to happen, it turns out because it's methyl bromide, because it's such a dangerous substance, they do have to let you know about 24 hours ahead. I contacted every regulatory arm, all of the places that should be issuing permits, and basically what I found out is that you can't light a cigarette up in a building in California, but you can tent and fumigate a house very close to another house with no permission or, anyway, it's a very, very frightening situation. I did manage to get a neighbor interested, and the two of us sort of aggressed the situation. The more we aggressed, the more we discovered that we had no rights. And in the end, what I did was I begged them to let me pay the difference between a non-invasive treatment or less invasive treatment and this fumigation. And I ended up paying $1,580 to have this house next to me that I don't own heat treated instead of fumigated. The difficulty here is that I had no rights, so I couldn't get competitive bids. I knew that there were alternative treatments to the heat treatment. I couldn't get bids on those. Basically, the industry sort of closed ranks on me. They all know each other. So I was sort of told that I was lucky that I was able to influence the situation at all. This didn't sit well with me, and I thought that we better do a show on this, because this is a situation that does occur. Although tenting and fumigating houses doesn't occur every day, there are situations that come up where your neighbor is doing something that you may not really want on your property, and what are the ramifications, and what are your rights? So what we're going to explore today is both what kind of materials out there, and I'm going to use the example of this fumigation process, but what I'm trying to do is give you the tools. You may not get, in other words, you may not have someone fumigating a house next door, or you may need actually to think of getting rid of pests in your own house. But even so, what you may learn today is how to go about getting informed, educating yourself, and what do you do? Who do you contact? What sorts of things can you do to protect yourself in as much as you can? So what I'm going to do is start with Justin Rubin. I want him to explain the role of Pesticide Watch, and then I would like to talk with him a bit about what we've discovered, what the problem is with methyl bromide and some of the alternatives, and then we'll talk to Art Slater, and we'll talk about some of the other treatments which may not be so damaging to the environment and to people. Justin Rubin, tell us about Pesticide Watch.
Well, Pesticide Watch is basically a clearinghouse for information on pesticides and their health effects and safer alternatives to pesticide use. Basically, we provide people with informational materials on pesticides that might be used in their home or in the fields around their homes or in the schools where their kids go or in their workplaces, in their neighborhoods. But then also we can provide people with assistance or organizing and strategy assistance. What can you actually do about the fact that dangerous pesticides might be used in your community? How can you change that? How can you advocate and win safer solutions?
That's a good question, because what I discovered was that the only influence that I could do was financial, and maybe the only influence I could do would be to inform people so that people might begin to, because the other thing that happened is that nobody would give me the information. In other words, even the company that was about to do, I learned later that that you're supposed to, see, I'm not the client, though, that's a problem. I wasn't purchasing the thing. So there are things like an MSDS, a material safety data sheet. There's all this nonsense about legal doses. I mean, basically what happens is that people are told methyl bromide is the only way to kill wood-boring beetles. Now, that's not true, because I talked to Art Slater and really did my research and discovered that's not true. But that's what they tell you. That's the only way to kill them.
Absolutely not. And Art can talk more about some of the alternatives, but there are things like heat treatment, which you talked about, and cold, and microwaves, and
Right. Well, there are alternatives that we'll talk about later, but what is this bit with no rights, absolutely no rights?
Well,
what's the politics of this situation?
The politics are that the agrochemical industry and agribusiness is a tremendously powerful political force in this state. And so what we've seen time and time again when we try to deal with this on a statewide level is that basically we don't get very far in Sacramento. A great example of this is a bill that was in the assembly this year would have said that the most dangerous pesticides can't be used in schools and that parents need to be notified before those pesticides are used. And that bill was essentially gutted start to finish. I've the current version of it, there's almost nothing that survived from the original bill. Anything that really had teeth was taken out of the bill, and that was because of the efforts of the Western Crop Protection Association, which is the agrochemical lobbyist folks. And this had nothing to do with pesticides on farms. It had nothing to do with crop protection. Mm-hmm. We don't grow crops in schools, last time I checked. But the fact is that anything that smacked of suggesting to folks that pesticides might be dangerous and that there might be a better, safer, more effective way to deal with our pest problems than spray and pray basically was deep sixed. The good thing is that we have seen that these alternatives are out there, they work, and that people in their communities, when they organize, have really been able to win some really phenomenal success.
If they even know what's going on. I mean,
absolutely.
I remember it isn't just... I mean, this business if somebody puts up a tent next to your house is I mean, and being notified like 12 minutes before, what if you, God forbid, you want to leave while they're doing it? Because it's, in the case of methylbromide, it's 5 days. And I got some information on some websites, a number of websites out there, but there is a website that I knew about that I was reminded of called Xtoxnet. Extox.net, and I'll give you the email address after toward the end. We'll give out, and also I'm leaving the email address and some phone numbers at the front desk of KPFA, which is 510-848-6767, and then you dial 0 for the operator and ask her to look it up if you miss some of this stuff. But even if you used your search engine and did extox. NET, you'd probably get Extotox. Anyway, this is a number of universities. Here's a little information about methylbromide, which is the one they like to use the best. About 1,000 human poisoning incidents caused by methylbromide exposure have been documented, with effects ranging from skin and eye irritation to death. Most fatalities and injuries occurred when methylbromide was used as a fumigant. A typical delay onset of symptoms following exposure, combined with an odor threshold at which most people can smell it, well above the level at which toxic effects occur, means that the victim may not realize a harmful exposure is occurring until it's too late. Toward the end, the toxic effects of methylbromide can be delayed or prolonged. Additionally, once in a cell, this chemical inactivates many enzyme systems, so prolonged small doses can cause severe toxicity. Toward the end, it mentions that it's the problem with it when you're using it in fumigating is that it does seem to dissipate in the, supposedly dissipates in the air, but it goes into the soil and has existed for 30 to 60 days in the soil. Some leaching may occur in the soil. It causes things like testicular cancer. It attacks all of the main organ groups in your body. This is a great little chemical.
Not the sort of thing you'd like to feed to your kids.
God forbid that they do this next to some. But, this is no notification. This is happening. And they're spraying field. Oh, boy. So what? Give us some good news. What's going on? Are we getting anywhere with? I saw an article in the Press Democrat that came out of Sacramento that said that the environmental groups are trying to stop it because there's no regulation. I called the government agencies, too, around this, and there's absolutely no regulation. There's no need for a permit when somebody uses this.
They don't need to get a permit for residential fumigation on a case-by-case basis.
Right.
It's true. So
but they don't even have permits, period, because we tried using your advice of calling this the
right.
Yeah, it did nothing. The Agricultural
their licensee
Commission.
Uses it every year. And so, one thing to realize, just one more bit of bad news before the good news. This chemical, and it's just one of many that are just as dangerous, we should point out, and that many of which are used in residential situations. But methylbromide was supposed to be banned in 1996.
Right.
And basically, after some very frenetic lobbying by the chemical industry, Governor Wilson called a special session of the legislature, which was really unprecedented, just to extend the ban on, or extend the period for which methyl bromide was allowed to be used, and it continues to be used today. And it also happens to destroy the ozone, so the Clean Air Act says it should be banned in the U.S. in 2001, and there are real strenuous efforts right now to actually gut that law, gut the Clean Air Act, so that methyl bromide will continue to be used. So you really are sort of right at the heart of where industry is using their influence to continue to expose folks.
There's other ridiculous situations. I'm sorry to interrupt you,
nope.
But there's other ridiculous situations, like somebody who works here at KPFA, a programmer at KPFA, the entire apartment was methyl bromide, and he had no control over it. He was allowed back into the building, and it was very ill for a long time afterwards. There also is situations where people live in residence where they come through and spray for ants on a regular basis, and we'll talk about some other treatments for ants and stuff in a minute with arts later, but... So how do people deal? How do we have some influence here?
Well, the first thing is that our experience has been that frequently one person acting alone doesn't have much influence. So whether it be someone, you know, talking to their neighbors or making a stink with their residence association or their landlord or their school district, typically one person, no matter how right they are, won't get very far. But the fact is that in many cases, the information is on our side, that there are, as Art can talk about, there are lots of good alternatives. And so getting those alternatives into the hands of the people who are making the decisions about pesticide use and pest control is a really critical first step, getting that information and getting it to them. And there's lots of good resources out there we can talk about in a bit. And then rallying the support of the other folks who might be affected, whether that's the other neighbors,
But what good does that do? Because I had several other neighbors, and we were all,
right.
I mean, they came out and they talked to us, and they all said, there's no problem. Here's plenty of space between the houses, you know.
Well, and there's a case where you're being given basically bad information. And residential fumigations are very difficult because you have a short time frame. The owner who's ordering it is leaving, and then it's very difficult to find out who the new person is who's buying the house.
You can't legally find that out.
So that's a very, very particularly thorny situation. But even in that case, I definitely can point to a number of cases where people have been able to stop those fumigations. And the key things have been to get enough people concerned that the real estate agent or the buyer realize that they may be moving into a neighborhood where everyone is predisposed against them. And
yeah, but how do we get that through? See, we had no access to any of these people.
Well, this is difficult, and there's no magic bullet.
No.
But what has happened is getting a lot of neighbors to sign a petition, bringing that to the real estate agent, letting the real estate agent know that you want to convey to the buyer that the buyer might, in fact, be endangered by the treatment that's going to happen because many of these fumigants can hang around in homes for
period. This is for sure, but there's a law in California, well, I don't know if it's just in California, that if you interfere with a contract, you can be sued.
And I've sort of solicited a couple of legal opinions on this point, and the vast majority of lawyers I talk to say that if you're just providing people with information on alternatives and communicating your concern, that you should be pretty safe. So I'm not a lawyer, but the bottom line is that in cases like this, these fumigations, and then particularly in cases where it's a neighborhood and the people are all living there, and so you have a little bit more time to organize, even though people don't legally have any rights, no one wants to have all their neighbors hate them.
Well,
and no one,
yeah, that's
you know,
provided,
and
this
and
is all provided if you have time, which you often don't.
I think you did a phenomenal job, and
well,
you know, ultimately,
it's expensive.
Ultimately, you did. You know, you didn't really have much of a choice. But to realize that there are a lot of situations that folks are in where they were getting the neighbors together, or getting the residents in condos or townhouses together, and going to the board, or getting the tenants together. They even though you don't have any legal rights in that situation, if enough people are concerned, it becomes more of a headache to keep things the way they are than just
annoying.
To actually start looking at those alternatives.
Okay. We don't have a lot of time, and I want to move on to Art. Let's give people practical information. First of all, there is another chemical that's used in fumigations called Vicane, which is sulfural fluoride. It's a fluoride gas, and too much fluoride is not a good thing. Believe me, it's. But anyway, the information that I got from XToxNet is limited. There haven't been sufficient studies done on sulfural fluoride. Is that right? It looks like there's not enough information. It looks less dangerous than methyl bromide, but it doesn't look like there's been any studies done on it.
Well, some studies have shown that it can affect has reproductive effects in lab animals, and another thing is it has a great ability to hang around in porous substances like furniture and wood and leach out, or not leach out, but off gas.
Mm-hmm.
Off gas over a period of weeks.
Here's another problem. There's a gentleman who is associated with UC Berkeley who does get funding to do studies, but his studies evaluate the effectiveness of chemical treatments and alternatives. So he is increasing the awareness of alternative treatments to people who don't really want to listen, but he's also in many cases showing that the chemical treatments are more effective. And when I pressed him, he said that he does take money from the chemical company. So this is a real mixed bag. And he's got websites all over the internet. It's the UC webpage for this thing. And it's very dicey because he doesn't mention toxicology. Now, one of his students, one of the graduate students in his office, did say to me, this is what he's doing. He's evaluating. There is a reason for doing this. This is important work, and this may lead to some changes. But it's important for the consumer who is trying to find an ally and who's looking for information. So good information you get from where? Let's give people some idea of where to go for stuff. You go. You call Pesticide Watch, and if you're not too busy,
In San Francisco, you can call 415-292-1486.
Okay, now give people a chance to get a piece of paper and repeat the number.
415-292-1486. Or in Southern California, you can call 310-397-1168.
Let me give out the XToxNet website. It's a long one, guys, so it's http://ACE, this is all small letters, ACE.ORST.EDU/INFO/EXTOXNET/GHINDX.HTML. And if you missed that, after the show, call the front desk of KPFA at 510-848-6767, extension 0, and have her rousted out of the binder for my show. There are many other websites. There are the important thing about the XToxNet is that you can put in anything. If you're dealing with somebody doing ant sprays, or if you're worried about home products, any product can be done by its product name, and they'll just give you the sheets on it. Anything else that we should tell people?
There's another great resource right here in Berkeley, which is the Biointegral Resource
mm-hmm.
Center, or BIRC.
BIRC.
And
mm-hmm.
They're at 510-524-2567. And they're just a phenomenal repository for information on alternatives to pesticides and on less toxic and non-toxic pest control options for all sorts of different problems.
Okay. Now, we've got about 5 minutes, and then we need to go to a 30-second break, and then we'll come back. But I want to start talking to you, Art. One of the things that was crazy-making is this business of people saying, well, you know, if this was just termites, we could do a heat treatment, but this is not termites. This is when I called you, and you said, uh-uh,
yes.
There are some alternatives here.
Okay, there's several complications in the system, as you pointed out. One is that the different insects have different susceptibilities. Termites care for their young, so if you kill off the adults, the whole colony dies. With beetles, the beetles lay the eggs, and that's the last they care for them. So it's much more difficult to control beetles. In fact, for beetles, the preferred method for the industry is methylbromide because it penetrates and kills the eggs. However, for sulfurofluoride, you have to up the dosage tenfold, which makes it much more expensive, and then it's still not as effective as methylbromide. However, the heat controls, and the problem with beetles, if it's local, you can just tear out the wood, or you can spray it with a borate like Timbor.
Yeah,
no
there
problem.
Is, we should mention that there is this product made by Borax called Timbor, T-I-M-B-O-R, which is a Borax product which can be sprayed, and it prevents reinfestation.
It
so
does indeed.
No matter, mm-hmm.
And the fumigations have no long-term benefits.
That's in other words, they can reinfest, is what he's saying. Even after you blast them with methylbromide and heat, they can come back.
2 weeks later, the wood is suitable for reinfestation, and then they come.
But you can spray after heat treatment with
And you can spray after heat
and
treatment.
And it's a borax product, so it's low.
The one of the problems in fumigation that most people aren't aware of is a few years back somebody came through and said fumigation should be cheaper. So they lowered the price.
Yes, they did.
Which means that people want to use methabromide because methabromide is the least is the biggest profit margin. And it'll work. So on that basis, people say, great, if you do heat fumigation, you have to put in heat sensors, and they have to be thoroughly distributed. You have to get all the sites, and you have to make sure that the areas reach the thermal, the critical thermal
Yeah, it's very labor-intensive.
Or it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm, it's labor-intensive.
And so it's more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But it will work, and it works just as well as methyl bromide. It kills them just as dead.
And maybe doesn't kill you
and
in the process.
It has less environmental effects.
Yeah.
Certainly. There are some problems with some building materials and heat, but it's for humans, it's certainly less intrusive, less of a problem. But those are the critical things, are the cost and the difficulty. But certainly for long-term effects, the borates are much better if you can reach the critters. And the only time you'd ever have to fumigate for beetles is when they're up in the walls. If they're just in the substructure, you spray with Timbor and you get perfectly good effects.
Well, you say fumigate or heat. Also
well, heat is also
walls.
Fumigation.
Oh, okay. That's considered fumigation.
It's called heat fumigation,
okay.
Methylbromide fumigation, Vicant fumigation.
Okay.
It's all the same kind of process.
So the other treatments like the cold treatments and the microwave treatments and the other heat treatments are best for what insects?
The other treatments are best for very limited situations. When you look at an entire building, all of those treatments, the Villa Termiti, which is a test structure at Richmond Field Station, manufacturers, representatives were invited for microwaves, for electroguns, for all of the materials. And the only ones that worked were the fumigation materials.
Including heat.
There were all, including heat, and all of the others, the microwaves, the electrical treatments, all failed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to take a very brief 30-second musical break. We'll come back, and we'll continue this conversation on your own health and fitness about the hidden dangers of residential pesticides. I have Art Slater from UC Berkeley and Justin Rubin from Pesticide Watch. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman. We'll be right back. The less toxic treatments, which include heat, which is also called a fumigant, is more difficult to do when you're doing a whole house treatment. A whole house treatment, there are heat treatments, for instance, that do spot treatments. And when you're doing a spot treatment, they can partially heat areas and things like that. So, the things that work best, well, you're saying that all of the fumigants work better in general, but are there not things like, I mean, regularly, there's so many different
okay.
are there other situations like, there's a million different kinds of insects. We've got drywood termites, which are very hard, and we've got the beetles, which are hard to deal with.
Well, for the spot treatments, liquid nitrogen and virtually all of them work quite well for very limited areas, but when you get into whole structures, that's where you run into problems with the spot treatments. For other insects, on the Berkeley campus, for the last 4 years, we've virtually not sprayed. And, of course, I've had the program for 25 years. And when I started, it was a spray program. But we're getting much better pest control now. We're down to 2% in our student housing of the cockroach complaints that we used to have. On the buildings, I hired in 1974 a lady to work in one building on cockroaches, and now we have one or two complaints from all 260 campus buildings a month. And it's all boric acid and baits. No sprays at all.
Yeah, we're talking about roaches and ants.
And for ants, we're looking at baiting outside. No treatments inside at all.
Uh-huh.
And just baits.
And you're using what for the ants? Boric acid?
We're using granular...
diatomaceous earth?
We're not using diatomaceous mm-hmm. earth at this point, but we're looking at some sugared borate baits.
Mm-hmm.
And on over-the-counter, the combat granular bait works quite well outside. Particularly early in the season.
I have somebody that does a non-toxic treatment in my house. As somebody in the North Bay has a company called Biopest, which he was one of your students, actually. And he uses absolutely no... I mean, when we say no chemicals, boric acid technically is a chemical. You know, you can get crazy, the boric stuff. But he uses, everything is low toxicity, and he baits outside he made a sugar base with the boric, and they go to that. So there's an enormous number of different ways. The thing that's interesting to note here is that when people see ants, they spray for ants, but you have to respray and respray and respray. And so when they look at a non-toxic treatment, they say, but this guy has to come back every 2 weeks to keep checking the bait traps and keep making sure that it's, you know, it has to be maintained. But you have to maintain when you use toxics as well.
Okay, the problem with Argentine ants, which is
what we mostly have, yeah.
They need, if you treat a column of ants, you get 5 to 7% of the colony. The colony can survive with 1%. So spraying ants isn't, you can do it forever and get nowhere. However, baits are taken back to the source, which may be in your neighbor's yard. And heaven help you if you go spray your neighbor's yard. But baits will get to the source. They're a little slower, but they're much, much more effective.
One of the things that's confusing when you're looking at a neighbor doing something, like spraying their yard with something horrible or fumigating their house, God forbid, or one of these things, is that, you know, when you start to look for the information, it gets mightily confusing. And one of the things that I mentioned to you is that I did go to this gentleman with the website and all this kind of stuff, and I said, people think you have to use methyl bromide on these powder post beetles, and he said that's the most effective treatment. And I said, how about the heat treatments? And he sort of argued with me, but he gave me the number of Dr. Ebling. Am I saying that right?
Ebling. Walter Ebling.
Who's quite old and retired. Did not want to talk on the show because he's quite retired and he really doesn't want to talk about it anymore, but he's the developer of the heat treatment. I called him and I said, did you use this on powder post beetles? Oh, yes, we used
Absolutely.
It on powder post. Yeah. So I called this gentleman back and I said, you know, he said that he used it effectively and it worked very well. And he said, well, he never published those reports. So another thing that people need to know as consumers when you're trying to protect yourself is there's this whole thing about published versus non-published research. And that's an important point to make here as well, I think.
Yeah, in the scientific world, the first person who publishes, even if it's been common knowledge for 200 years, gets credit for the invention. And although that's somewhat cynical, that tends to be how science works. And so publication actually validates information, and unpublished information hasn't been peer-reviewed for journals and therefore is looked upon as unproven.
All right, let's go over what we've talked about. What we're saying here is there's another thing we should talk about here, Art, is that there's an issue about how to protect your house so you don't get these creatures. Like the powder post beetles are caused by what? Why do they happen?
Powder post beetles are usually in wood that's a little bit damp, and so oftentimes a way to eliminate them is just to improve the ventilation. Another thing that's being done in areas where there's severe termite problems is in frame structures are being treated with borates as part of the building code, and that would certainly eliminate any powder post beetles or any other beetle problems.
So they'd be soaking the wood in these borax type.
In borates, yes,
yeah.
Honolulu, in Sydney, Australia, and a number of places.
And borates are not toxic unless you happen to eat a lot. Is that so, Justin? It's like boric. It's like the. Borax that you
poisons.
Put in your.
Yeah,
huh?
They're digestive poisons.
They're contact materials.
Yeah, you don't. So you don't. It's.
I mean, they can definitely be dangerous to kids or pets if they're able to ingest them. So.
But we're talking about this. It's similar to the thing you're putting in your laundry.
Mm-hmm. It'll help fireproof the house a little bit.
It's also good for removing molds. Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
And molds. Yes.
Yeah, it kills mold. But we're talking about a material that, you know, if you spoon fed somebody some borax that you use in your laundry, that would be a bad thing to do. But
it can cause all sorts of reproductive effects, actually.
Uh-huh. But when it's sprayed on something and it's in the air, it doesn't linger in the air and end up, in other words, breathing it or contacting it, you know, wood that's been treated is not dangerous.
Yeah, it's not volatile. So
it doesn't move. It stays put.
Right, and it doesn't
Whereas
out gas.
Whereas if your neighbor sprays and you measure all the areas around your neighbor's yard, you will find evidence of the spray used.
If you use an insecticide, you mean if you use a pesticide?
And most of the organic materials, yes.
Just a super quick point is that a lot of this stuff can be dealt with without using any kind of chemical at all, even so-called natural chemicals, and you know, Art's a real expert at that and uses a lot of that in this program. Very common sense things like improving sanitation and making sure buildings are caulked up and the cracks and crevices are closed.
Well, my favorite pest control now is a vacuum cleaner. Really?
Yeah, but, you know, this issue of maintaining dry, keeping, you know, especially with the winter we just had, having some visqueen in your crawl space so that you're not having wet, damp earth invading.
Absolutely. Maintaining conditions that are not favorable for the pests is really the best way to deal with them.
And what are some other ones? Say, we've talked about the moisture problems. What's the deal with termites? What's a good way of keeping them out of your hair? I understand ants are actually a predator of termites.
Ants are not a very effective predator of termites. The termites and the ants have lived together for many, many years, and ants will eat termites, but the termites continue to live in the area, so I'm not sure how good they are. For instance, not building flower beds next to your house and backfilling dirt against the wood. Or re-leveling your yard and putting dirt up against the wood so the termites can go directly into the wood. It's a very common problem. Redoing the drainage so that water piles up in the house.
Mm-hmm, that it moves away. Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of things that people do to make conditions worse, probably because they don't realize it. But earth-to-wood contacts, moisture situations, all of those are important for pests.
This means having a sump pump in your crawl space when we have a rainy winter, so you're carrying the water away, making sure you've got good drainage, putting some kind of vapor barrier on the ground in your crawl space, or you're keeping your basement dry, keeping your house warm enough.
Maybe putting more vents in the walls.
Lots of vents,
putting
fans
in to get better air movement.
And I would guess that having someone sort of take a pass every once in a while to watch for any evidence of anything, so that if you do have something starting to happen, you can do a spot treatment, which is not terribly expensive, and you can use these liquid cold things, or you can use the heat treatments, or you can use the Timbor in these spot treatments and stop it before it invades.
Or if you put Timbor under your house, you won't have to worry about it, ever.
Well, and so if Timbor, so we're talking about, like, if there's Timbor under the house and your pet walks around on the Timbor and gets it on their paws, is that?
You spray it up in the wood.
Oh, you spray it, okay.
Yes.
Oh, what a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? That's what I needed you here for. You know, this is your own health and fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I have Justin Rubin from Pesticide Watch with me, and I have Art Slater from UC Berkeley, entomologist. So just to quickly review what we've said is if you discover a pest problem, there are a variety of different ways of looking into finding. And do you guys have some kind of information line for people who want to use non-toxic?
There is a university information line, one at Davis, which I don't have the number.
Which department do they call?
It's Extension Entomology, or Extension Cooperative Extension, I believe. You could find that number out. 642-5565 is the local number, which is somewhat limited in the accessibility.
So 510, wait a minute, 510-642-5565 will get you to what?
UC Berkeley Urban Entomology.
Okay, and that might be able to get you through to a number that would give you some information?
And they have the Davis number, yes.
Okay, so UC Berkeley's Urban Entomology Department is 510-642-5565. We've talked about XToxNet. Justin Rubin at Pesticide Watch has lots of papers available for people if they contact. We've also got Bio Integral Center in Berkeley at 510-524-2567. I will run very quickly to the front desk at the end of the show and put down the numbers that I haven't already got on the sheet. If you need to get these, they're at 510-848-6767, extension 0. Any last things that I'm not mentioning here? Are we missing something before we open up the lines to callers? Justin, anything else you want to talk about briefly?
Yeah, just to reemphasize the call, because there's a lot of information. This stuff's pretty confusing, but we can, depending on what people's particular situation is, we can link them up with folks who've already been in similar situations and who've been able to win and help them figure out how to do that.
And you guys get very backed up, I've noticed.
Well, you called it a bad time because we had a couple of people on vacation, but we're working hard to be able to get on site if necessary and help people however they need. So,
how are you funded?
Typical nonprofit mix, combination of people who are members, and we always need more members. And people are welcome to call if they want to join.
Why don't you give the number out again?
It's 415-292-1486. You'll get some excellent newsletters with a lot of this information all year round, and you'll be helping us to reduce pesticide use across the state.
Art, any last things you want to mention to people?
Yeah, the
people?
Last thing is that, first of all, you have to know what the pest is. Many pests are just lost and easily disposed of. In most instances, spraying is not necessary at all. There are other better ways to do it, vacuuming, baits, wash them down the stairs, whatever.
Yeah, soapy water is great for
so
that stuff.
So stop and think, identify the pest, figure out what you're going to do. Quick and dirty pesticide use has a lot of things that you don't want to have happen can result in. I don't use sprays at all because they go in places I don't want them, which is why I use baits and other more localized materials.
Well, there's no end of material being published right now about the endocrine disruption and various other things that we suspect are going on, so I think it's pretty clear that there's a bill using a chemical, and it doesn't look as though the chemicals are more effective.
Yeah, I want to disrupt pests, not people.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think it's encouraging to know that you've been doing this at the UC campus for all these years and not had to resort to something. Again, when we say non-toxic, we're talking about safer. We're talking about things that where you're weighing the consequences and looking at it. I guess what I would say as a last-minute thing to people is you mustn't be passive in this situation. If you rely on a termite company to tell you, or if you're even getting information from other people, find out how are they invested? What is their concern? What is their you know, what are they, if you're talking to a termite company, again, the less invasive treatments are more labor intensive. They want to offer an inexpensive price to people. They don't want it. They told me, the people who I talked to that have these termite companies said that they often don't discuss these alternatives because they're expensive. So you have to ask. And you have to get some of the information yourself. So you must take the time to review things and get informed. And watch out who you're getting informed by. Make sure that these are not people who are somehow being bankrolled by... I mean, people have to... Research projects are fueled by industry who has money. It's very expensive to do research projects. Some of that has to be weighed. You just have to look at what you're looking at and weigh the information. So... I think we have some anxious callers on the phone. So for those of you who want to join the show with this is a show on the dangers of pesticides in the in residential areas. And I have Justin Rubin from Pesticide Watch, and I have Art Slater from UC Berkeley. He's an entomologist. We're opening up the lines to those of you in and out of the area code at 510-848-4425, 510-848-4425. Please remember to turn your radio down before we pick you up. Who's our first caller? David from Oakland, go ahead, please.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to mention that I feel like there's a connection between a person, people selling a house and new homeowner purchasing a house, and the pest reports that are have to be brought, mandatory that are brought in.
That's correct.
I feel like the pest report is... usually, in the case that I've seen, vastly overrated. And
yes, I think that's true.
And some in the area of sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, and as it turns out, the repairs could be done at sometimes a quarter or half the cost.
Well, they have to pest when somebody does a pest report. When somebody does a termite report, which includes repairs, they are liable for it. If they miss something, they have to pay for the repair. So they're likely to give you an estimate that's higher. You don't have to use them to do the work. But keeping to the subject of what we're talking about today, what is your point real quick? Because we've got a lot of callers.
Well, my point is, what's the reason that it's so mandatory that each time you sell or purchase a house that you have this particular report that has to come out and
okay.
that you...
All right. Let me try to answer that.
Are people paranoid of the pest?
No. Let me try to answer that. I'm going to let you take it on the air because we've got so many callers. My understanding is that there's lots of rules about disclosure in California, and the other thing is what I just told you, which is that if you buy a house, you need a good termite inspection because if there are repairs or if there's invasion from pests, and you're buying the house as is, that's one thing. Also, the termite company is liable for all of the work. If they miss it, they have to pay for it.
But there's no legal requirement. The reason that people require termite reports is because the loaning agency won't grant the loan without them.
There you go. Okay. Let's get another caller on the line. Ellis, go ahead, please.
Hello. Thanks a lot for your great show. Flea infestation. I was over at a friend's house, and they just sprayed the area where the dogs were with this stuff. And it just is there anything to handle flea infestation?
You actually
there's
are,
some really
yeah.
good materials.
Yeah.
Fleas used to be number three on the money-making list for the structural pest control industry. They've almost fallen off it, and the reason they've fallen off were because of materials like the topical treatment materials, which are work excellently, program, and there's a new trap out that Raid has that is a light trap that brings the fleas in and traps them in sticky substance. There's a better one put out by that the light blinks called the Ultralight, and it'll trap 100% of the fleas within 20 feet in a three-day period.
That's impressive.
So there's lots of new stuff out that's low impact.
You don't mind imidacloprid. You don't mind Advantage. You're not worried about
Advantages, of all the materials, imidacloprid seems to be the least problematic at this point. And it's also good for termites, for subterranean termites, called Premise.
We've also had some success with folks using just diatomaceous earth on pets and on rugs.
Never worked for me. Sorry.
Depends. Definitely know some folks who've had that work. And you know, one thing to remember when you're sort of playing the this chemical off that chemical is that there's a lot of health problems that we simply just don't know about. A lot of these things have never been tested for their chronic effects on our neurological systems, our brains. Endocrine disruption is basically a new thing. We still don't really understand what it is and whether or not a lot of these things are problematic. So there's a whole host of things that we don't know. So if you can get away without using them, I certainly wouldn't want to use them.
It's interesting to note, too, that not all pets are allergic to fleas, and not all pets become really badly infested, too. And it seems like the healthier pets tend not to bring fleas into the house, and obviously not having rugs helps.
And you can have problems with pets with diatomaceous earth that have skin conditions that get desiccated. So there's nothing that's
perfect.
Perfect.
Yeah. Let's move on to Ray in San Francisco.
Hi, you know, I guess it goes without saying, but maybe it might be said that what you are talking about here is about making a safe island out of your residence, but that in most cases, say, maybe with the exception of some employment and schools, a lot of institutions, it's not, there's no guarantee that you won't encounter residues of various kinds of toxic materials, say, in public accommodations, hotels and such, or in transportation like international air carriers and so on. But what we're thinking about now, when we're looking through our home for signs of these pests, we know what the ants look like. We know what the cockroaches look like. But suppose you were looking at a place, maybe you're not the owner, maybe you're renting a place, and you want to look for evidence of termites, and you want to be on top of that. What are you going to look for these beetles that you mentioned? What are you going to look for as evidence?
What a great question.
Well, with termites, usually they're discovered when the alites come out, when the winged forms suddenly explode through the walls or on the outside of the building. That's usually about 5 years after the termite colony actually starts. With beetles, you probably wouldn't see them unless you looked actually under the house or in the beams that they're coming out of, because they're not likely to appear in the inside. The ones that do appear on the inside, Lictids true powder post beetles, are only in hardwood, so they're not in the framing of the house. They'd be in hardwood floors and furniture, that sort of thing.
The other thing is just to ask. If you ask your landlord who the pest control company is that they're using, and talk to that pest control company, they or the landlord will be able to tell you what materials they've been applying. And, you know, I think it's a great question, but the first part of it, the premise that we might not be exposed, particularly in schools and some workplaces, is actually not true, because you're right, we are talking about safe islands of our homes, but the truth is that really nasty pesticides are used in most schools, in most workplaces, and in most neighborhoods. And so you're absolutely right that we can change the stuff in our homes, but we have to deal with this problem more systematically if we're going to really be able to change things.
And methylbromide is still being sprayed on fields, is it not, if you live in an agricultural area?
Well, it's injected into the soil.
Yeah, it's injected. Used as a soil fumigant.
So it's low, but it's
still... Methylbromide's always used as a fumigant.
Mm. We work with folks who have schools that are literally, where the classroom buildings are literally 5 or 6 feet from fields that are fumigated with methylbromide, and kids go home and teachers go home sick every time they fumigate.
Oh, jeez. Let's move on to Norma in Berkeley.
Hi. This is a very narrow range of information in the sense of these wider things, the major pollution of life through bad use of pesticides is what's really important for us to deal with. But I do a real estate agency in the area, and one of the things I've learned is that roof drainage is tremendously important.
Good point. That's a good point.
And so taking your roof drainage in good gutters away from the house, downspouts away from the house, to help maintain a dryer underneath has been like central to what's been advised by my inspectors.
Well, as you point out, moisture conditions are the major problem with wood structures. About 70% of the damage is done by fungus, not beetles and termites. And that's due to the kind of condition that you're talking about.
Who do we have next? We have Ernest, San Francisco.
Hi, I just have a quick question. First of all, just appreciate the show. Second of all, just have a quick question if you could comment on a seen advertised electronic devices that I guess purport to get rid of.
Okay, in short, they're useless. And what happens is the people that produce them advertise them, go out of business before the regulatory agencies can catch up with them. Okay. But my friend Professor Mike Rust has one in his cockroach colony. Rex Marsh put one in his rat colony at Davis. The animals in both those colonies are perfectly happy. Don't waste your money on the electronic repellers.
Thanks.
Let's move on to Ted in Irvine. Ted, go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, about ants and ant baits, I've tried the commercial ant baits, including the combat one, I guess.
Hmm.
And all the ants do is walk around it and on it, but they don't seem to do anything else.
Do you know what species of ant you're dealing with?
Well, they're a little small. God knows what they are.
Can't you tell Argentinian ones smell bad when you squish them?
I haven't noticed that, but I'll try it.
Well, you might. The thing about baits is timing is critical. The protein-based baits, combat bait works best early in the season. And so when you see them first out in January, February, I'd bait them then. You'll probably have better results earlier in the year. As the colonies get older and have less brood, you get less favorable results because they gather the protein to feed the brood.
Okay, well, I had an ant guy out. He did put bait around. He says there's no way I could get that kind of bait.
Might be Niban. I'm not sure what kind of bait he was using. There are a series of different ones. Niban is 5% boric acid, so it's a fairly favorable bait.
So if combat didn't work, what would I do to get some of my own bait?
Well, combat sold over the counter. There are a lot of materials sold over the counter, and I'd try materials and see what the ants will take.
They sure didn't take that one.
Okay, thanks for your call. Yeah. We can't, it's hard to but I, there are these companies, and they're all over the place now. Well, not all over, but there's several of them in many different areas. I know there are in the North Bay, and there's, I'm sure, in the East Bay, companies that specialize in less invasive pest control treatments, and you can contact them. They're around. You just have to know what to ask, I think.
Yeah, you have to persist. As the market develops, it'll become easier and easier.
I think in the long run, also, it's cheaper. I mean, my experience of using this person is that he comes out every 2 months. The treatment is roughly, in this particular case, just to give people a vague idea, it's $65 every 2 months. And I had ant nests everywhere. I had an incredible invasion that wouldn't respond to any kind of anything that I was using that was natural. And they're gone. And but in the meantime, he's also watching for any evidence of other pests. So I think it's well worth it to have somebody sort of do that. We're out of time. I really want to thank my guests. Art Slater from UC Berkeley. I think we decided that if people needed to contact UC Berkeley for information, they could call a main number for the Urban Entomology Department at 510-642-5565. If you wish to reach Pesticide Watch, Justin Rubin, the number again is
415-292-1486.
Thank you both so much for coming in person and taking the time to do the show. It was very reassuring for me anyway after what I went through. If you missed any of this and wish to have it in your own cassette, you can get a copy of today's tape, and information on how to do that is on my voicemail. Listen to it all the way through, and you can also call me during normal business hours at this number, 707-769-1458, 707-769-1458. For a list of other available shows, send a self-addressed business-sized envelope with 2 stamps to P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. Next week, I'll be doing a show about how little we relate to death, both metaphorically and literally in this culture, and what we have to learn from other cultures who seem to have more of a relationship with death. I'll be interviewing psychotherapist Dr. Suki Miller, author of After Death. I'm Lena Berman. This has been your own Health and Fitness Show on KPFA and KPFK FM. Thank you so much. I'll see you next week.